And so we would, the students would have to work on this text for, they're the intensive students that come during J term. And so they would spend a whole week on this text. So I'm going to try to boil this all down, this lecture down to an hour. And it's, I use Caroline Lewis's and Don Jewell's work for some of this, but, and some of this connects. I know you were there, Lynn, for Mike's thing yesterday with truth. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so some of that overlaps a little bit with that. But anyway, let's first of all start with prayer. Gracious God, your word, ancient and wise, comes into our midst to tell hard and honest stories about offensive things, stories of sin, decay, of decomposition and ash, of dust and death and need. But hidden always, somewhere, our song is that some days that we might have something to do with saving our life, at least just a little bit. But your story nails itself back into itself, so we turn, hopeful or reluctant, to discover we must tell the truth of us, but mostly the truth of you. For we find ourselves in your story. You, this word that tells us that though we stand in earth and of earth, you tell us it is not all goodbyes. You, this peace, when shared, reaches into shuttered tombs. You, this promise, your story now born upon blood and wine and bread and body, you turn toward us, and now all things lift a visible song. Amen. Okay. First of all, I think, hi Trish.
Hey.
Grab a Bible, or I'll grab one for
you. I've got one, I brought one.
Oh, you are just, is it a new Revised Standard?
Yes, it is.
Okay, good, because we're going to be all working from the same translation today, and that's, it's kind of important that we do so. Today we're going to geek out and do like Greek stuff, but I'll do the heavy lifting for the Greek for you. Some of you know Greek or have learned Greek, but we're also going to do a little bit of literary work in the Gospel of John, and how many of you feel familiar with John, the Gospel? You guys, too, you idiots.
Yeah.
I always forget this is going to be on tape somewhere.
Is it really? I don't think they tape my implants. So.
I don't know. I'm hoping they
don't. I think they do.
That's
really?
Just a,
I think they tape everything. Oh, good Lord. Well,
yeah,
you'll hear me
like
saying, oh, good Lord, on tape. Anyway.
I know, freak. So anyways, what are some, John is full of images and uses images all over the place. So first we're going to start by brainstorming, and I hate that word, what are some of the images that you know that are in John, especially related to Jesus, who Jesus is?
The bread of life.
What's that?
Captain Hook.
Captain Hook again. That's a, yeah. I had more trouble, you know, I was thinking of the sword thing yesterday with Paul. I kind of weave
yeah.
that in. Might be harder today. Oh, no, I can do it.
Oh, good.
I can do it. So I'm going to put Captain Hook down. And what I'll put under it, behind it, is weapons. But that's, that's for later. Any other images that come to mind that are key?
I think the thing with John is I have less images.
Really? Yeah, that's interesting because John talks about, let's see, I have just a gap here, but The cup is one. He refers to the cup a lot in the Gospel of John. And that means suffering. Also, light. He's the light of the world, right? Sheep, shepherd, sheep, garden, gate. And these are all important to remember as we go through, especially, well, this one not so much in our text today. This is Jesus' rest, but all of these things are very important to remember as we think about our text. Because the Hebrew, if Paul used rhetorical devices and common of the day to get his point across to people, the gospel writers of all four gospels used different kinds of things, alliteration, repetition, rhyme, puns, because as Don Jewell argues, these stories were not meant to be, you know, your Bible was not meant to be put on your bedside. These were stories meant to be read in the community. So you would use these images and all these kind of like language things and things, you know, you're writing for the ear because you're building tension in the story for the Gospel of John. You're building tensions towards the, as you move forward. So John places all these sort of things in within the story. And in the text we're just about to read, you'll see that how these all come into play. It's really fun. Anyway, it's fun for me. One also thing about the Gospels that's a little different from Paul, but not totally, is Paul was more Greekified, and a lot of the Gospels are writing to a Hebrew audience. And what's important, and you probably all know this, even if you can't articulate, what's important to the Hebrew people? What defines them? What makes them who they are? How do they still tell? What's the story? What's their story?
They never got over being slaves.
Passover.
Okay.
These stories, the Passover, define them as a people. And the Passover was the freeing event for the Hebrew people. And remembering was key to them. So we... So remembering is a key thing in the Gospel of John. Okay, we're going to start in, and we're going to go verse by verse, and we're going to take it really slow. And I want you to, as I read through the Gospel of John, and we're just reading 11 verses, and what's so interesting is that we read through the stuff, like, and how thick it is. It's so thick. And to pay attention to the details, because the details are what matter. The details are what make the story. Okay. After Jesus had spoken these words, he went out with his disciples across the Kidron Valley to a place where there was a garden, which he and his disciples entered. What details do you see? Just name some details in that story.
Garden brought to mind the Genesis story.
Ding! Garden. I'll just underline that in green. Yeah. Because John begins his whole thing with, grab a Bible. Welcome. We're in John 18.
Okay.
So, what was I just going to say?
It begins it all with...
Yeah, he begins with the word, it became flesh and dwelt among us, and, you know, so he begins echoing back, remembering back to Genesis and who they are. What other details do you notice in the story? Who is in this? Who are the people in this? First line.
Mary.
Jesus and his disciples. Okay. That actually matters. That matters because they go into the garden, and the word in Greek is eis. For those of you who remember, it's kind of like wrong. Which means, it implies that they go through a gate. That this garden is not, does it ever say in here this is the Garden of Gethsemane? No. It just says that it's a garden. And that they went into it the way this Greek verb is used implies the entrance into something that's enclosed, which harkens back to the shepherd sheep thing. Because Jesus talks about himself as the gatekeeper, you know, for the protector of the sheep. So you have all the disciples in the garden. And go back to what you're thinking about with the garden. What does that maybe mean to, if you're a hearer of John, you're remembering the story of Genesis, what might it mean to go, that Jesus goes back into the garden?
It's been many, many years since anyone was in the garden because they left.
Yeah.
It's been a long time away from the garden.
Oh, yeah. And he's going back into sin.
Wow.
He's going back into the place, and you're thinking, this is where it all began. This is where it all fell apart. I mean, yeah. And Jesus is taking his disciples in there. Anything else you notice just in that first verse?
Kedron.
Mm-hmm. Do you know anything about the Kedron Valley?
Not an awful lot.
Well, the Kedron Valley is only a winter flowing.
Yeah.
The valley only, the water only flows in the winter. And if you look it up on a map, it's just east of Jerusalem, and it's the same, sort of the same direction as the Mount of Olives.
Yeah.
And so that it's interesting that maybe, what does it mean that it's not an ever-flowing, you know, river, that it's just a seasonal river? I don't know. It might mean anything, but I think the details do matter. It could be that it's the boundary between Jerusalem. It could mean that because it's just a seasonal thing, that it's a torrent, you know, it kind of runs torrentially, like it's in the southwest of the United States. We don't really know. I mean, no one really knows. Everyone makes a good guess.
Well, the crucifixion is in being rising is associated with spring and the rebirth of vegetation.
Yeah.
And so the river would start to flow.
And images like that matter in John. That's why it's like so, you know, like these would be all evocative of places that they knew, and like that's kind of spring that kind of come into life. I mean, we might not know those places, but it's like people hold on talking about when, you know, the snow fell, or, you know, you would know this. Okay, just moving on to verse 2. Now Judas, who betrayed him, also knew the place because Jesus often met there with his disciples. So, there's a lot going on right there too. What's happening? Judas is introduced all of a sudden. I mean, it doesn't seem that he's with the original disciples, right? Judas seems to come later. Jesus goes in with his disciples, and then Judas, who betrayed him. And one of the things with Judas, he's mentioned 6 times prior to this. And he's mentioned as, he's the one that, like, he's mentioned as a betrayer. He's referred to as a theft. There's some puns around that. How do you spell thief? T-H-E-I-F. Okay, I didn't spell that very well, but he's referred to, so there's already a setup there. But he's not with the original disciples, is he? Okay. So now we know for sure that he is the betrayer, and he knew the place, and that this was a familiar place for his disciples. Verse 3. So Judas brought a detachment of soldiers together with police and the chief priests and the Pharisees, and they came there with lanterns and torches and weapons. So anyone see anything going on there that's like, how many soldiers do you imagine coming?
20.
20?
Many more than were necessary.
Do you want to know how many?
Yeah.
About at least 600.
600.
600. It's a cohort, and it's a detachment of soldiers. And so you can imagine.
Wow.
It's night in the garden. Jesus is going back into the darkness, maybe into sin. All of a sudden you hear all these soldiers, I mean 600, and they're probably there, most scholars think, because of the Passover, because it was a high festival day, and the Roman government needed more, you know, kind of crowd control because of the Passover.
Why does the word detachment mean to you that it's a whole regiment?
Well, it's just from the Greek. It's just the Greek that, yeah. That's lost in the... That's,
yeah.
You know, it's again lost in the English.
Yeah, in English that's lost.
No, and it's not true for the other Gospels. That's one place where John differs from the other Gospels. I mean, the massive amount of soldiers that is in John is just unbelievable. So you can imagine them, you know, chomping, and they're with the chief priests and scribes. So this is like representative of the whole world coming to get Jesus. Yeah, I mean, is there a kiss in this story? When Judas betrays him, is there a kiss?
What's it going to do with that enclosed garden? That's no escape, kind of like,
uh-huh.
Or I mean, one escape, but through.
yeah, it's. And you have to remember, these things were written on, like, these writers of the Gospel, or Paul, they couldn't, like, go, oh, I don't like this copy, I'm going to, you know, throw it in the recycling bin. They had skims, and they had to watch every single letter they wrote, because these things were precious. So they didn't write anything that wasn't important. And so even that it says... lanterns and torches and weapons. Those extra ands in there are in the Greek. And it's like, so you almost have that feeling, that's why it's like lions and tigers and bears, oh my, you have that kind of, they're coming. And what, if Jesus is the true light of the world, what are torches to the true light of the world?
Nothing.
They're kind of a false light. So you really, you know, a first century reader would be getting all this kind of, and this is a great story. So, let me just make sure I'm not missing anything. But yeah, so you have over at least 600 men coming and with a nighttime arrest, and it's sort of funny. I mean, I think it's sort of funny, but this is where the Captain Hook thing works, is they come with weapons, Sophie. Do they need, if you have 600 men and you're after one person, do you need weapons?
Yes.
Do you? Oh, yeah. So yeah, the weapons are kind of almost ironic piece in that. I mean, it's like, you know, we're doing that. Okay.
And I don't remember exactly how this plays in John, but I mean, he's I don't remember how John portrays him, but generally he's not seen as that threatening. I mean, threatening with his words and stuff, but not...
Yes, sir.
I mean, I don't know, people...
Well, you know, I think that's the kind of funny thing is that, you know... Who was I talking with yesterday about Barabbas? we're talking about Barabbas and yeah, and how Jesus, we were talking about how Jesus was this big threat when he wasn't a threat, and like, you know, the free Barabbas.
Oh, this is a funny thing I heard from Kinky Friedman, and it wasn't, they don't make Jews like Jesus anymore, his famous song, but he was speaking off the cuff to someone, and he said, they always say, free Barabbas, kill Jesus. What has Barabbas ever done? He doesn't call, he doesn't rape, he doesn't win any ball games. He hasn't done anything.
Yeah, no, I think that captures the kind of irony of, yeah, but that's later. Barabbas is later, but anyway. Okay, verse 4. Then Jesus, knowing that all that was to happen to him, came forward and asked them, whom are you looking for? Verse 4. So much going on there. Tell me, what's going on?
Bringing back an omni.
Bringing back an omni, yeah. You know, the other Gospels, Jesus is like crying sweat and blood in the garden and weeping, like, oh, make this cup pass. You know, please, you know, Father. Here, does Jesus, who's in control here? With all these 600 soldiers, who's in control of the situation?
Jesus is.
Jesus is. But what does he ask them?
To establish their intent.
Yeah, whom are you looking for? He knows. Yeah, he knows. And they answered, Jesus of Nazareth. Jesus replied, I am he. And we'll stop there for just a second. Because in the English it says, I am he. But in the Greek, that's not there. That he's not there. In the Greek it just says, I am.
That's the way he refers to himself throughout John.
Yeah, some of the time.
That's the intensified first person singular.
Yeah, and the added he is not, but in this, they have to add it in English because
sure.
It doesn't make sense. I mean, it's like, I am. But if you heard Jesus reply, I am, what are you remembering? What story?
Creation story.
Yeah.
Creation story? Moses in the burning bush? When Moses is in the desert and says, tell me, you know, who I'm supposed to go to, you know, this is this freeing event. Who, you know, what am I, who should I said sent me to you? You know, I'm going to the, you know, Pharaoh. And all Yahweh replies is, I am. I am who I will be. So, you can imagine these readers of John, it's like, they know this is God. This is a divinity thing. This is not, in other gospels, there's the human Jesus, but this is the divinity, and Jesus is in charge. Judas, who betrayed him again, was standing with him. When Jesus said to them, so Jesus is standing, or Judas is standing right there, I am. They stepped back and fell to the ground. What happens when you encounter God?
Prostrate yourself.
You prostrate yourself. Exactly. And who is they? We don't know. Is it all the soldiers? I mean, that's a powerful thing.
It's loud.
It's loud. There's a lot of clanking. A lot of weapons hitting the ground. It's like all of Captain Hook's ship. Like, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Again, and this is like a literary form of repetition. Again, Jesus asked them, whom are you looking for? And they said, Jesus of Nazareth. Jesus answered, I told you that I am. So, if you are looking for me, let these men go. Who are the men do you think he says to let go? There's the disciples there. There's the chief priests, the scribes, and the 600 soldiers. What does that harken back to?
Let my people go.
Yeah, Moses.
I like to think that it's all the people there, all the men there, all the soldiers there. Let these people go. Let all these people go.
Yeah. And they're not needed.
Hmm?
They're not needed.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And, you know, it's so interesting because there's all this military force and all this military might and this darkness and night, and it would be scary. I mean, it's like, I can't even imagine, you know. But Jesus just seems totally calm in the situation, unlike the other Gospels, completely. And his calmness almost seems like a joke in the face. It makes all the weaponry, all the weirdness of their overreaction to him kind of seem absurd. I mean, you know, because it's like clearly Jesus is in control here. Okay.
Why does he ask the second time?
I don't know.
It's just funny.
Maybe to establish for the hearer.
Like they've already fallen down after he spoke. Like it's pretty clear.
Yeah.
He's the only one standing.
I know. He's the only one that everyone's like down, falling
on
the ground.
And then he asks them again.
And he's standing.
Aren't they afraid to say his name because they're going to fall down again?
Like he who shall not be named or something?
Yeah,
like,
why
did
they didn't fall down the second time. Like, wouldn't they be afraid to say it? Because
over and over again.
I don't want to fall down
that's
again.
That's like a Monty Python film.
Yeah.
It's like, don't stop saying it because every time you say it, I am.
Yeah.
Tend to think it's a because this was written for the ear, it's a literary device,
yeah.
So people really, because all of a sudden Jesus is talking in all these images through the Gospel of John, and you're going, what does that mean? I'm the shepherd, I'm bread of life, I'm the light of the world, whatever, I'm truth, blah 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 blah. And all of a sudden these things just in these things. Okay, verse 10. Then Simon Peter, who had a sword, like Captain Hook, drew it and struck the high priest's slave and cut off his right ear. What do you think Simon Peter was, I mean, what was going on there? I mean, there's 600 soldiers there.
That's how I cut off the ear of a slave.
Say more.
It's, I don't know whether you all know more about it than I do, but it seems a little bit chicken if you're going to cut off the ear of somebody, cut off the ear of a slave, and he's probably not going to be getting serious trouble for that.
Yeah.
Attack the unarmed one.
Well, and why is the slave's name mentioned? Again, remember, every detail is important. Why would the slave's name, why would John take the time to write down that detail?
I think that as a slave, the slaves have very little opportunity to exercise any free will.
Yeah.
And that listening was the only thing that was predominant for them because they did whatever they heard.
Wow.
And that to cut the ear of the slave meant that you were sending a message that your leadership is not saying the right thing.
Wow.
Wow. Yeah.
Wow. I'm glad that's on tape. I love it. I've never heard that. I mean, I've heard all sorts of things about that. But, yeah, that's really cool. Now, this is one story that's in all the Gospels, but Luke heals the servant's ear, but it's not, the servant is not named. It's just a servant. Matthew and Mark, Jesus starts, after the guy's ear's cut off, Jesus starts teaching on the nature of, you know, he starts going on, it's like, everyone will betray me and the nature of my rest and blah, 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 blah. Like, he kind of takes it as a teaching moment. But this one, he's, put your sword back into its sheath. Am I not to drink the cup that the Father has given me? Which that last line is so interesting, because the cup is mentioned throughout John, and the cup is suffering. And so what do you think that last line might mean? Am I not to drink the cup? He doesn't pray for the cup to pass.
No. That I'm not supposed to be exerting will. I'm supposed to be subjugated by the circumstances that I'm up against.
In other words, he's accepting,
his
destiny.
Okay.
Yet, you know he's divinity now.
Yeah.
And so, if you were the writer of John and you were trying to make the claim that Jesus is God, what does accepting that mean, that destiny mean, held in tension with the divinity of God?
I'm here to fulfill the mission.
Fulfill, yeah.
I like the sentence, the line before that where he puts in a name to this way, Malchus, because by establishing a name, then he personalizes and he says that little people matter.
Yes.
Okay.
I agree.
Do you know what kind of a slave Malchus was?
No, I don't think we know. We just know that he was one of the head honcho slaves.
He could have been a big time.
Could have been a big time guy.
Shaker.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But still a slave.
Yeah.
Yeah. He was still property.
Yeah.
And so the let these men go. I mean, what does that mean? There's a certain craziness.
There's a little craziness in
the
transaction too.
It's turned because the people that have come to take Jesus to the cross and who we think of as bad people are being seen as the equivalent of the Israelites as slaves in Egypt.
Yes, yes, yes. And they matter.
Yeah.
They matter. These people that are even the enemy matter. I mean, is that what God's, Jesus' mission is to free all these people from the whatever binds them? I mean, whatever is like, even the enemy?
I mean, they can't be an enemy if the whole thing is for Jesus to drink the cup and everybody's the pawns.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't mean to be sort of crass like pawn, but I don't know, their actions don't really matter.
Bob Dylan had a song about that, Only a Pawn in the Game. Wasn't it Bob Dylan? One of those singers. I think it included Judas, and obviously Judas, because better for him not ever to have been born. It's the way that Jesus talks about him in one of the Gospels. But without that, without this event, Jesus would not have been able to have been handed over to his fate. So,
I know, and in this Gospel, it's necessary. I mean, it seems that acceptance of his fate seems like, key to the necessary to start. The Gospel of John was the last Gospel written. Some of you may know this. Probably around 90 A.D. Mark was probably the first, written after Paul, somewhere around 45, 50, maybe 60 A.D. So there was quite a bit of time between the first synoptic Gospel, which would have been John, and this one.
Mark.
Huh?
So it would have been John.
Oh, sorry. Yeah. So by this time, it's almost, 100 years after the event. And so at least a couple of generations have probably passed away, and they're trying to, John's trying to create this story as, truth for this new community that's of believers. And so he takes a little bit of a different angle on it, but he taps a lot into the whole identity as their truth. And Jesus is redefining that. Other thoughts?
Well, it seems to me that when Jesus rebukes Peter there, it's just one more example of Peter not getting it.
Oh yeah. That's one thing that's pretty consistent with all the Gospels, is Peter is like, just doesn't get it.
Yeah. But even if he loved Jesus, that would be so hard to accept.
Isn't that true? I love Seymour.
And I think too about his going to sleep. I know a lot of times I get sleepy when I have to go. I'm going to go through something unavoidable, and it's better than being anxious and having a heart attack. And sleep is a good way to avoid what you don't want to face.
Yeah. In this gospel, Peter doesn't sleep.
Uh huh.
That's because there's a Garden of Gethsemane in this gospel.
Right.
But Peter consistently, but it is like, if someone was hurting someone you love, but the slave, that's an interesting choice. I don't know.
He might have just been nearest.
I think Peter is every man, because I think that we all shirk our responsibilities and we dodge and hide and we do all kinds of things.
Yeah.
To not do what we should be doing.
Yeah.
I understand Peter. I'm just patient, but as I read, but I understand.
I am Peter. I agree. I mean, he's a complete idiot, but so am I.
Well, he acts before he thinks, and I think that my read of this is that he just picked the person who's closest to him.
Yeah, that's what I mean.
I don't think there was a lot of significance in it, but.
Well, he would have been stopped if he had gone very far.
Yeah.
I mean, if he would have moved very far with his sword,
all 600 soldiers.
Yeah. So he had to.
One swift movement, that's it.
But, I've had people in my class, this is one of the exercises, and they work all week on this, one of the exercises is they do it in the Greek, but it's to notice the details for your preaching. Because we miss so much reading through, and we think we know the story because we've heard it, and we collapse the Gospels into one, and there's particularities that make this story really very powerful. And so by the end of the week, they all have to preach a sermon on these 11 verses. And one of the things that one of the students, I remember, he was like a source person. And he noticed that Malchus's right ear was cut off. And so he was like figuring out, like, okay, was Peter left-handed? Or was he side foot? So he really got into, like, how the...
I wondered that, too. I saw that right ear.
And
what's the significance of that?
Yeah, that's...
He could have done it from the back, but couldn't. They would probably say right ear from the back would be the left ear from the front, so that wouldn't matter.
Could be.
You'd actually have to have a pretty good aim to cut an ear off.
I think so.
I couldn't.
As opposed to slashing him down the middle of the face or just completely missing his head.
It could have been behind him, too.
No.
Yeah.
Yeah. But I love how people get into that detail. Yeah. People are like, they'll stand up,
But I wonder, symbolically, you're saying John is such a big fan of symbols and stuff, does the right ear, like your thing, is that the ear with which he listens to the high priest, or?
Yeah.
Does he sit on the left of the high priest and therefore that's the one he uses. Or,
yeah.
Or the other way, and that's the one he doesn't need.
So, if you were going, we're going to go around, and I'll just give you a moment. If you were going to preach on this text, what would you say? There's so much here, but what would you say? Let's just take a moment. And I didn't catch your name. I'm sorry.
Dean.
Dean, are you a preacher?
No.
You should be.
In the kitchen with me.
You should be.
There you are. I'm a catechist.
You're a cactus?
Catechist.
He's a cactus. He's a little prickly.
Cactus. What is a cactus?
I teach the catechumenate.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Yeah. Are you Episcopal or?
Layperson.
Layperson? Okay.
Yeah.
Interesting. Anyway, sorry. You should be, just take a couple of minutes. And then we'll start with Brian.
Mm-hmm.
And end with Trish. And whenever you're ready to go, Brian.
Something with the the light of the world and the torches and the, something along those lines.
Dean, what would you tell us?
I think this is maybe a retelling of the Moses story, and there's lots of images from the Old Testament, and since Christ is fulfilling that prophecy, I think that's what I would stress.
Yeah, interesting. What I love is that, I mean, I'll say this before everyone talks, what I love is that you can take 11 verses and everyone can say something deeply profound, but completely different from the other person.
Yeah.
There's just so much
Absolutely.
There. There's so much there. Chris, what would you say?
I'm drawn this morning at least to think about whom you seek.
Oh.
Because that's they. I think they think that they're seeking somebody that they're not exactly sure who they're looking for. I think there's a little confusion. You know, there's not that kiss, but Judas has yet betrayed Jesus.
Yeah.
And at the same time, they. You know, they. They think that they're looking for somebody, or they're looking for some person under certain circumstances that may not be the case.
Yeah. Interesting. Yeah. And yet they sent 600 soldiers out to look for this, you know, I mean, some kind of, yeah. But isn't that what we do with that confusion?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, yeah. I mean, isn't that what we do for now?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Lynn, what would you tell us?
Well, I guess I would...
Bless you.
I would focus on the idea that Jesus was the only one who really knew why all this was happening. And that the high priests were fearful that they were going to be challenged by the priests. High priests were looking for somebody who had committed treason,
mm-hmm.
and and they knew that the people were expecting a Messiah to come and overturn everything and restore the Jews to their former glory. And I think that's why all the soldiers were there, because they expected some sort of mob action. And that Jesus and perhaps the other disciples who apparently did nothing, maybe they got it, although I doubt it, because you get the message all the way through the Gospels that nobody ever really figured out what Jesus was up to. So I guess my focus would be no one really knew what was going on except Jesus here, and he knew his mission, and that's all there is to it.
Yeah, no, that's great. I mean, and that we're still need to be free. I mean, you know what I mean? It's Jesus is in control. He's still the good shepherd. He's still the light of the world. He's still, yeah. I love that. Kari?
Just a quick question. Weren't the soldiers Roman?
Yeah.
Yeah, so doesn't that make a little bit of a difference because they don't really have an axe to grind?
Yeah, you think there's, I picture a lot of 18-year-old boys going,
yeah.
What are we doing? I don't know, they just told us to go. You know, like, that's what you're, and maybe staying with the pawns, they're like, they had just handed me this torch and told me to walk. They don't know, they're just like, keep the Jews in control over the Passover,
yeah, right.
But they really...
Well, a revolt would have been of considerable interest to the Romans.
Oh, yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
So they're really... just there because the high priests have asked them to be there.
Yeah.
I mean, the implication is the high priests are in league with the Romans because they don't want things overturned either.
No, and it's Passover, and so, like I mentioned, there's probably so many Roman soldiers available because Rome sent in to Jerusalem these extra soldiers to keep the Passover festival under control because they feared... that there might be trouble.
And it makes me think, you know, the issue with the sword and the ear and everything, it implies to me that the soldiers are standing away from all of this. Because if the soldiers were right there and one of those guys draws a sword, I would imagine there would have been some action.
Yeah, and then the sense of the garden, too, being enclosed and that... the disciples were just in there because in verse, Jesus leaves the garden for a little bit, and then I'm trying to find the verse there, but he goes out of the garden and I think confronts the soldiers, where is it? But anyway, so that it seems like the soldiers are on the outside somehow. Making sure people have time to pee, 5 minutes to pee, or do whatever after another coffee.
what struck me was the I am part, especially that he says it 3 times. I just, that's what stood out to me, that just that his holiness as verb is what shook their verb and made them fall down. You know, it's...
Oh, I like that. Holiness is a verb. It shook their verb
like,
and made them fall down.
Their being was, like, their ultimate... I am... Like, you are from I am. And that being, that essence shapes you.
Yeah.
And I think that's... pretty cool.
I do too. I think, you know,
I like the way you put it too. That his verb shook their verb.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Shisha, what did you tell us?
I would just, that when it dawned on me that these people who were Christ's captors were slaves like the Hebrews had been. And that we are all slaves to something, and it goes back to that verse that many of you know probably what chapter that we're in, where Jesus essentially says to, I think he's encountering somebody with wealth, that we're all slaves and that we have to kind of choose.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. The rich young man, rich young ruler, I think.
And that if we're going to be slaves anyway, we need to be slaves to the light.
Mm. Slaves to the light. That's a poetic. Well,
it's poetic because I couldn't think of the right words to draw it out about the, you know, community, you know, et cetera, et cetera.
I think slaves to the light just works fine. That's beautiful. Well, thank you guys. It's like always fun to everyone had a different, somewhat different take, and yet, you know, all were textual and all came from the text. And my thing, and what I always tell people, read your Bible slowly. Take the time to notice the details. Don't assume you know the story, whatever it is. It's same with life. Notice the details. Notice all the things that, you know, because that's where the beauty is. So I thank you all. Anything else that we should talk about before we close? And
how many people besides myself have been put to sleep in a way by being told Bible stories as children, and then maybe going to lesson choiring churches for a while, and this was the story, and finally too late in our lives, we do start reading for ourselves instead of going reading the Bible through the filter of our youth, when people, we listened to people who were very sure of what it was all about. And I wish that I had, you know, read every word for myself when I was much younger, instead of just being conditioned to read it through the filter of the people who told me the stories.
Oh yeah, I resonate with that, because we had one Sunday school teacher. Well, first of all, in one of my former churches, the kids didn't read the Bible. They read stories about the Bible, you know, reductions, and they were usually a little moral object lesson kind of thing. And one of the teachers would tell the kids, that the Bible is God's little instruction book. And I just, you know, I'm like, you can be a first grader, you can be Toby's age, and you can talk about sin, not as like sneaking a cigarette or cussing, but waiting for the bus to come and being the youngest kid on the bus. We all know babies cry in the dark and want to be held because they know what original sin is. You know, and so that teach our kids, you know, like when you're alone, when you're afraid, when you walk into the lunchroom, all those feelings that we have of knowing the darkness and knowing, you know, fear and shame, wondering if we matter. All those things are really, I think, the heavy-duty stuff we should be talking about from the very start, rather than being nice. Don't talk in church, you know. But it's been so filtered through manners, the Bible.
One of my observations has been that people that are sure of what the Bible says have read it by themselves and not in community. One of the things that we did in this group just now is that we listened to other people's understanding and had perspective and realized that there wasn't a truth that was black and white. It was, you know, just lots of different things. And that doesn't come out if you read it by yourself. It comes out when there's, you know,
no,
several people that can discuss line by line and put it in perspective.
Yeah, no, and that's exactly right. The reading of the Bible is an oral event. It's a communal event. We gather to remember. We gather with our bodies.
And it's the reason we need community, and it's the reason that,
And when people feel more comfortable when everybody is thinking like them, then they stunt their growth.
But you don't learn anything unless you listen to somebody who thinks a little differently.
Even if they're wrong.
Even if they're wrong.
If they're wrong. But I mean, every single time I do this with, you know, and I'll do it with 30 students, and each student will have a different, I mean, they'll be similar, you know, the overlap, like light or, you know, the I am, I mean, there'll be an overlap. But each person, the text becomes embodied in them. There's a merger. And we know that our God loves to attach God's self to bread and wine and word and ordinary things. And we never, ever doubt the efficacy of a baptism. We never just say, I don't know if that really attaches God's promises to that water for that kid. Or when we go to you know, communion, we never question that, like, God is actually present, you know, born on ordinary crappy wine and bread, sometimes wafers. But we do question, for some reason, that God will attach God's promises to us. And we wonder if we're worthy. And I mean, I think one of the things is we find out when we gather and we talk is that God will attach God's promises to us in all sorts of ways.
Well, I think it's easy for us to turn that around and say, well, if I was in charge, you wouldn't make it. And then it comes back upon you, and yikes, well, I'm not in charge. Am I going to make it?
Yes.
There you go.
Yeah. But God will attach God's promises to you. Yeah. And there's no question about that. And you got to live with it once you're a Christian. Tough luck. Okay, we got to go. I'll just say go in peace and serve the Lord. Thanks be to God.
Thanks be to God.